Take it away, Dave.
Well, welcome everybody to the, September 22nd, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR and HAMSI, Personal Space Weather Station Project. So this week, I have been working on the webpage, and so I added a first whack at an overall status page and changed its link in there. I also added links to the DCC day-long streams in the video section and adjusted a bunch of, took away the TeamSpeak links and adjusted the names a little bit. So that's about it for the website, but based on requests, we have some headway, and I made a system so that we can be flexible and add more status things, finer detail if necessary. So next on the list, let's go down the list. Next is Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. Things are moving along here in Scranton. Always stuff to keep you busy with classes and all sorts of meetings. Let's see. I think the most important thing, Scotty, I think we are getting through the rebudgeting issues. So I think we're about ready to for me to place that order for the magnetometer stuff. So if you think that's ready to go, I'll just send the request to get that processed. And then, yeah, just pretty much moving along. I also posted the HAMSI workshop or the HAMSI website, the links to the HAMSI workshop videos, which have been up for quite some time, but I just got them on the HAMSI website a couple days ago. W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. And see, this week I've been mostly spinning my head around in circles, trying to get the data engine finished up with the interfaces to the leaf board for the which we're going to use the first out for the VLF module, and also the IO to the clock module, which I think I've got that pretty well down. But I'm having difficulty with getting enough IOs, so I want to talk to Tom a little bit about that in the after period here. But I think I'm going to end up having to steal some IOs from the RF modules, at least on this version of the board, because I just don't have enough pins to do what I want to do. So, I mean, one of the other things I could do is I could put some level translators in, and especially we put them on some not important clock pins, or maybe we could run some of the pins on a different IO level to the VLF receiver, which I've been looking at too. So, that's pretty much what it's been going on over here. And finally found my my Intel eval board that was secreted away in storage in hundreds of boxes. I narrowed it down to with my, yeah, you get, that's the one. I actually found it, if you can believe it, because I was, when I started packing up the building, I was marking everything that went in every box, but that got so incredibly tedious. It was taking way too long, so I got sloppy at the end, and I just would say like development kits or, you know, boards from office or something like that. So I ended up having to go through about half a dozen boxes before I found the one that it was in. So I got that, found that, and then I also retrieved from storage my Linux FPGA development station. Thinking I'm pretty much resigned to the fact that I'm going to have to go back to it to do the RAM design, which means the FPGA design. So did that, and I think helped Dan. You got set up with Cordis. I think you're all set. And okay, and that's it from here. Take it away, Dave.
Okay. Next on the list is Dan N4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave. Well, I did a little bit of traveling this last week, so I didn't do a lot of radio stuff. I did get the Altera Intel board. As Scotty mentioned, I have Cordis up and running in Windows and in Linux. Had a couple of little issues with Linux that were kind of self-induced. If anybody starts running Quartus in Linux, remember to generate some dev rules, UDev rules files. Otherwise, you won't be able to connect via USB. By Ethernet, it won't be a problem, and the USB Blaster works both by Ethernet and by USB. I also found one of my USB Ethernet dongles, and I know it's real because the instruction and data sheet in it is in Chinese, so I know it's authentic. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. Well, next on the list, we have Dave W, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Not sure what I've been doing. I guess I've been working on software, and I got myself a, I got a working magnetometer rig that I can actually use for software stuff and probably even put out in the ground. But I did it by subversive means. I've gone completely around the demonically possessed PCA 9615 chips and have instead used the, what is it, an LTC 4311 active LTC 4311 kind of an active terminator that seems to work very well as far as I have exercised it. I'm not using differential I2C. I'm using just the plain old plano, but it seems to work nicely over a 50-foot cable, and I haven't stretched it out, put out a longer one, but at least that gives me something I can use. So I went back and fixed one or two bugs in the software so that some kind of testing can go on, and I guess that mostly I'm trying to clean things up before I, because I'm going to be out of the loop for a week or two. So that's it. Over.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have David in 1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Hello. Not too much to report on this project. Continuing to work on professional stuff. And the big project this week actually was repeaters. We have one new repeater we're putting online that's keying itself up. And then our existing repeater systems getting interference on 220 of all things from Connecticut. We're up in New Hampshire. It's coming straight up the Connecticut River Valley.
Yeah.
Somebody's got a very high powered link radio with a beam on it. And I got to find out who's
it's pointing.
And they're
at
not
you.
IDing. So such is the life of radio guy. Back to net.
Well, that's the guy's probably sitting there and saying, nobody uses 220. I can do what I want.
Well, this is actually a repeater system that they have down there, and they're using the 220 to link various repeaters.
Yeah.
But they have no idea that they're making it out this far.
Well, I'll go on to the next one. Next on the list is Bill Engelke, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dave. Good evening to you. Good evening to the net. as I might have mentioned last time, I've discovered that the Raspberry Pi works fine as a local host for the Tangerine running using the data engine simulator. And so I'm starting to switch things over to that because they are cheaper and more plentiful than the Odroids. And so I came across the idea. I realized that now that I have all of the code that requires high speed implemented in C and running as separate processes, maybe I don't really need main control. Maybe I can control the data engine directly from the web controller, which runs in Python, which will take the middleman out of that circuit and maybe solve some software races that happened, some edge cases where you click two buttons too quick together and it crashes. So I'm gonna look at that. So the major thing with getting that to work is the discovery routine. So today I took the discovery routine and jacked it around so that it can be executed from Python and pass back an array of structures that list all of the HPSDR compliant devices on the line. So far I've tested it with the simulator and the Red Pitaya, and you get the data back and all the ports are right and everything. So I'm going to see if I can come up as a continuous improvement with eliminating the old block called main control. And so I think I can call everything from the Python routine. And so we're going to be testing that for the rest of the week. So that should give a little bit simpler system. As I've always said, complexity is our enemy here. So anytime I can simplify something, that's what you want to do. So anyway, that's what I've been up to. Back to that.
Okay, fine business. Next on the list is Dev KC3PVE. Go ahead, Dev.
Thank you, Dave. Good evening, everyone. So it has been a regular week for me. I'm making slow progress in my work. There has not been any breakthrough, so it's a regular week, and I'm looking forward to make some more progress. Thank you.
Well, fine business. Next on the list, we have Dick Patchy. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, Nathaniel, thank you. This is K2 Lima Charlie Tango, and I attended the GNU radio conference last week, and one of the last programs was by the NI guys on their EW and radar, it was on GPU servers. They found that the GPU servers were better when you had to have a lot of data going back and forth to the SDR radios. That's about all I have, Nathaniel. Back to you.
Well, thank you, Dick. And it's Dave that's running the call. And next on the list is Gary, AF8A. Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Not much to add here. I did take a look, Dave, at your little hardware project synopsis on the website you added. That looks pretty good. At the risk of asking you to do something which is really difficult, some idea popped in my head from my old project manager days. It would be kind of slick if you could hover over those blocks and see the name or the call sign or whatever the person that was responsible for them.
Oh.
Maybe that's way too much work, and if it is, don't even, drop it right there. But just a thought that popped in my head. Back to Ned.
I'll look into some sort of identifying of the project leaders, because what I have is very simple, and the content comes from a CSV, so it is easy to change and modify. Next on the list, we have James Wolfel, KG4DSG.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes. Go ahead, James.
Okay. I'm just listening in, find out what's going on with the project. I did spend some time last week with the GNU radio conference. A lot of it's over my head, but it's all posted online on YouTube, and I'm feeling I'm going to be going back through it. I did have a question. I think it came up last week about the data engine to the localhost protocol, and it was mentioned that you may fall back, at least initially, to the HPSDR protocol. Are the documents online up to date? Are they something that's pretty solid at this point? And I'll let whoever answer that. Back to the net.
Well, I think the documents we have online here, and I tried to provide links to the Open HPSDR pages. Those documents under either support or documents are what most people use for the protocol definitions. So I don't know, Tom, you've been involved in our documents. Do you have any other comments?
I don't think that we've documented the protocol like HBSDR protocol one. That's over on the Open HBSDR project. And Bill, have you documented anything or about the new protocol?
There is a first version that shows the sequence of events that is going to occur. But when you talk about the protocol, I'm sure what you're talking about is the details at the byte level of what goes back and forth where. And that I had a little bit of discussion with Scotty earlier in the week about that. It's something I'm working on, but Scotty assures me he doesn't need it until close to the end of the year. So I'm, rather than focusing on that as a priority, I have been trying to get the localhost built out. And interestingly enough, when I started thinking about maybe I ought to do all this from Python, it started me thinking maybe I can simplify this the protocol as well. So it's just as well that I didn't already document it, because we can even simplify it down to the point where you don't have to exchange any binary variables. Like, you know, right now I've got it in C and it's a nice structure with binary values. But what if you'd like to command this thing from NC, like just key in the stuff, you know, connect to the device using a TCP, a UDP emulation terminal, and just key in the commands and see if you can make it work that way. So I'm going to see if I can simplify that as well. So anyway, long story to say that we have a very preliminary version of it, but it's going to change. So probably give me another month or so on that.
So one thing we ought to point out too is that the protocol one we're talking about using is only for testing. That's not really what we're going to actually use in real life. It's just going to, because we have FPGA code that implements protocol one, it's very easy to throw it into the FPGA and debug the hardware. So not going to be an end goal.
I also want to mention to James, you can find Bill's work on his GitHub, which is linked under the code link on Tangerine SDR. It's called Tangerine Notes. Is that it?
Tangerine SDR Notes.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's the new one is Tangerine SDR -Pi.
Okay.
So the new stuff that's going to be Pi related. I thought I would not mess up what is up and running on the Odroid, but I created another whole repository for the Pi-based stuff. And I'm going to focus most of my activities on that.
Well, once you get to his GitHub, you'll find what he's documented so far.
I thank you. I didn't really mean to derail this thing, but I did find on the Tapper website, there's a protocol two, but you're actually talking about protocol one for testing, right?
Correct.
Okay.
It's quite a bit simpler. And so it's for a quick off, protocol one does almost no error checking.
Okay.
And protocol two put a lot of error checking in, and that's the big difference.
Well, I'll look around. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, back up to the list. The next one is John W4JKL. Go ahead.
Okay, hello everybody. Still lurking in the background here, watching over you here, and trying to keep up with what's going on. That's about it for me. I'm doing some more reading of the conference proceedings and the stuff on the HamSize website, and appreciate the nod of the head, and back to Ned.
Okay. Well, next on the list would be Jay, WB8SBI. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well and staying safe in these troubled times. Basically, I'm dropping into these meetings to of general interest on my own, and wondering if maybe when there are some production units or even prototype units, if I could possibly be a candidate to deploy that in my house as a monitoring station to gather data and input. So that's a possibility. However, I have a power transformer. The power company here has a transformer in my backyard. And so I don't know if that would screw up or mess up any of the readings. It's a 50 kVA unit. So don't know what that would do, if anything. In a related subject here, that doesn't have to do specifically with ham SCI. I'm an ARRL PIO, and at the last AMSAT conference in Virginia, I obtained a video on Oscar V, the history of Oscar V, and some of the guys who actually worked on Oscar V were there. I have that video. It's a 15-minute. So if any of you at your local clubs or Nathaniel at your club there at Scranton would be interested, it's a 15-minute video. I'd be happy to come to your meetings and play that, or to any of your other, your local clubs. It's really fascinating. It's a professionally done video. So wb8sbi@arrl.net. Otherwise, I'm just enjoying myself participating in not only the technical part of what we're doing here, but also the space weather part on the Thursdays. One other thing that did occur to me here, you're talking about the servers. In my day job, I'm a retired automotive cybersecurity engineer. And so I'm wondering what sort of cybersecurity is even being considered for this project. Now, you got to ask yourself the question, well, why would somebody want to attack it? Well, now you're getting into a whole ball, another conversation. But suffice it to say, somebody could really want to mess things up. Even if there's nothing of economic value there, it's the annoyance value. It's also, if someone wanted to be malicious, it's the ability to alter data, that you've got this data stream coming in, and they just want to mess it up. Is any thought been given to how we're going to protect that data against intrusion and anti-tampering, so that not only we have confidence in the data, but if we submit that data for anybody else for peer review, that they have confidence that it hasn't been altered in any way. Yeah. So yeah. I toss that out for consideration. Otherwise, 7-3 to all. Stay safe. Back to Nip.
I would think Bill might be the person we'd... Sorry, Bill, but you want to answer that question?
Well, as far as protecting the data once it's on the server, that is the domain of the computer science department, and they're charged with that. Protecting the data while in transit, I'm trying to use techniques that send the data using SSH techniques. One WAG even suggested that we ought to get a security certificate and install it for every person. Each person would have their own, and they have to be replaced, and they cost $25 a piece per year. No, I don't think so. No, we're not doing that. So you got to remember that this is not a professional thing. I mean, we can't do what Daimler-Benz or General Motors are going to do for this. We got to be a little bit. We're going to try and use standard internet security for the data in transit whenever we can. We have also talked about how to protect the devices from being hacked while they're sitting in somebody's shack. And I got to say, man, if you put one of these devices on the open internet, that's on you. You got to have this device behind your home router. As far as people putting it into a secure locate into a network situation, like in an organization at a university, once again, their security department is going to have to be responsible for making sure the thing is behind a firewall. So, you know, you can really go down a rabbit hole of security. And I know that, Jay, I'm sure you have done that many times and gone very deep, but you got to remember, this is a volunteer organization and our funding isn't unlimited. So,
yeah, I get it, but I just wanted to toss that out there because in the in the other world that, you know, you get all types of people for anywhere from state sponsored actors.
You're exactly right. We have to consider it. We can't consider it at the level that you may be used to, but we're not ignoring it either.
Okay. I'm good.
It's an interesting project because we have some NSF funding. We have universities involved, as well as a bunch of amateur radio operators involved. Now, a large number of us are retired engineers or professors. So, you know, kind of a background like you have.
I think one of the other things to consider, too, is that, you know, at this stage, we're still like very much in this prototyping phase. So I think Bill's approach is right, using standard internet libraries such as SSH to provide security and rely on these, you know, being behind home routers and making sure people know that you have to be behind something. But I think if we try to put too much security in right away, we're not even going to get beyond the whole development phase of just trying to get something that works at all.
Well, you know, the other thing is that you got to be careful that you don't have to have real serious IT skills in order to be able to set one of these things up and put it in production.
Let me ask this question. How at the server side, when you're receiving all this data, how easy is it to incorporate some mechanism to say that the data that was received has not been altered, either in transit or at the server side? So in other words, it's at the server, and to make sure that it wasn't tampered with at the server.
People doing something with a check digit, or a hash, like you put on software that you're distributing, that might be an option.
Yeah, because that sounds like something that may, and again, I'm not a big box IT guy. I'm an embedded software guy. I toss that out there.
But one of the things...
As something to consider, that's all.
One of the things that to consider, too, is that we're running an OS, so a supported OS. So we have all of the resources available that OS provides us, as opposed to the roll your own bare metal where we have very little support. So that may help us in the long run implement whatever security we need, as opposed to trying to roll our own security, which would be daunting.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. Trying to roll your own is way out of scope for this project. Yeah.
If you're doing everything through a secure shell tunnel, or through like SCP, that's going to include a certain amount of security right there and protection against the data being tampered.
You know, it's even there's even a capability within digital RF to add check digit information to digital RF record by record. But let me tell you what a hit that puts on performance. I couldn't keep up with the data in the small board computer system. So yeah, we're going to have to just do the best we can with what we have.
I totally get it. Yeah.
Well, I would
say that there are great consequences to mucking with the data anyway. You just end up not having the data from a particular station.
Or you don't have the data station. I was thinking of if someone got into the main server itself, where you've got all this data from everybody and was somehow able to alter that. And that would, that mean that all that effort that everybody's put in is essentially down the drain.
That's behind the university firewall, isn't it?
It will be. Yeah. It'll get the...
University firewall.
The university is... Let's put it this way. The University of Alabama is a big target. Everybody knows it. And you can't get on any system unless you have at least two-factor authentication for every single thing you do. And
a few years ago at my alma mater, Lawrence Technological University, they had a disgruntled student who, from the inside, he literally... shut down the entire university system and destroyed just terabytes of data. gone. Even when they recovered from the backups, there were still terabytes of research data, financial records, everything gone. They found out who it was and why he did it. He was disgruntled because his girlfriend was not accepted, was denied admission. But so it was an internal attack. Oh, yeah, the FBI did get him.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, how far down the list are we?
We're almost there. I'm trying to get back on calling the list so we can get to the open discussion.
We got down a rabbit hole. Okay, back to net.
Okay. Let's see. Next on the list is Jonathan, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. I don't have much to report. I have been working on homework primarily and trying to stay sane. Other than that, I'm interested to hear what Scotty has come up with. Announce anything he has. And that's pretty much it. Back to Nick.
Tom, I'm going to call on you next. Tom, in 5EG.
Okay. Real quickly, Scotty, the ICD document for the receiver that's on the Tangerine website lists the connector utilization and pins. So if you want, you can grab that document and you'll find there's a whole lot of unused pins. And so you might want to use that as a guide. Secondly, do you have an estimate of how much RAM is going to be attached to the FPGA?
512 megabits.
Okay.
So that would be 64 megabytes of RAM, of DDR RAM.
Okay, that's fine. I'll probably, at least in the receiver characterization, want to snatch full rate buffers out of the ADC using the memory and then dump that to an analysis program using GNU Radio. So that answers that question.
We'll have to manage that because the processor runs out of RAM.
Okay.
The processor.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, 32 megabytes, something like that. Well, we'll figure it out, but at least there's enough there that we can get some fairly long data records straight out of the ADC.
If we need to store some things, we have 512K of QSPI, and I forget how much serial ROM we have, but there's two. They're ROMs, though. They're persistent. So if you need to store something, you could do that, but I wouldn't want to be using them for dynamic buffers because you wear them out.
Yeah, no, I just, the RAM, it would just be for test mode only. And that's just so we can grab a big buffer out of the receiver and then dump it to an analysis program. And that will allow us to do some dynamic characterization of the receiver. Okay, back to Ned.
Okay, fine business. We still have Jules on the list. Jules, you want to make any comment?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, this is my first attendance of one of the Zoom sessions. I've been working with Dave Witten to continue testing of the RM3100 magnetometers. I just actually pulled in my 400 feet of Cat5e that I've been running one of the magnetometers at the end of in a underground situation for temperature stabilization, because I want to build two RM3100s into that housing to be able to do a direct comparison between two units into the same temperature environment and also the same local magnetic fields, just to look at the variations between just a pair of the RM3100s off the shelf. So far, the routines or the runs I've been taking, the daily runs, I've been agreeing very, very nicely with what I see on the intermag.org site from Fredericksburg, Virginia. And again, just collecting data for noise analysis and general performance analysis to assist Dave.
Well,
back to Ned.
Jules, I've seen lots of your work and it's pretty amazing what you've been coming up with. So very pleased with some of your results.
Well, thank you very much. Going to continue testing. We'll give feedback as I get it here.
Yep. Really appreciate it. So I think we're to the end of the list. Have I missed anybody? So we're open for general discussion.
If I may, for Bill Engelke, you mentioned you ported the software to Pi 4, which I think is great news. But have you done anything about active cooling? Because there's a history of the Pi getting very hot.
Well, the one I have came with a fan. I mean, buy that little kit. Now, are you saying that the fan isn't enough either?
No, no. Just out of the box, a regular Pi has no heat sink and no fan. And it will actually thermally throttle itself during boot. It gets hot fast. But you're saying the unit you have has already got a fan on it?
Yeah, I just bought a kit that came with the power supply and case and fan.
Okay.
Now, just parenthetically, I have so far tested it running four subchannels, two of FT8, one Whisper, and one major channel that's simulating six channels at 8 kilosamples apiece. And I only saw occasionally the CPU utilization go above 10 or 12%. I mean, when you do the big FFT of a million and some points, it spikes up to 25% for a couple seconds. But we're not driving this thing as hard as I kind of expected. But, you know, it's going to be capable of putting out an awful lot of data, too. I mean,
yeah, it's a capable processor, but it's well known that during the boot sequence, the CPU will actually go into thermal shutdown and throttle itself back unless it's got some kind of cooling on it, whether it be a heat sink or a fan. But that's all that it really needs. And if you say you've got a kit with a fan, that's probably perfect.
We should probably recommend to people, if they're going to build a system, they buy a kit with a fan. Because it would be the silliest thing in the world for us to put all this high-performance stuff together and then not be able to get the data through the system.
Correct.
That'd be so silly. So
I have a little, I'm just kind of showing it on the screen right now. This is a Raspberry Pi 4 with two little heat sinks on it. I run this thing with SDR software. I very rarely see it go above about 59 or 60 degrees centigrade. That's about the maximum. And that's running probably around 40%. So with passive cooling, under most circumstances, I don't see too many issues with it.
It's something we're going to have to be aware of, absolutely.
The Odroid unit you had, did it have passive cooling that you were using?
The Odroid has passive cooling. I mean, the Odroid is interesting because it's bigger than the Raspberry Pi physically, and the entire side of it is one monster heat sink.
Okay.
But the latest version does have a fan that you can put under the whole thing and cool it down.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Scotty, I just counted down the list. There's a little over 60 pins on the receiver that are not connected.
Right. And so what we did is we reserved pins on the connector for two receive channels and one transmit channel. The receive channels being 17-bit differential, 17 differential pairs each, and the transmit channel being 14 differential pairs each. The idea being that we could use 16-bit ADCs with an overflow bit, that would be 17 bits, and on the transmitters we could use 14-bit DACs, and they would fit into the transmit channel. But I'm happy to reserve those pins for future use, but in reality they go to the FPGA, so they're all programmable anyway. So you can assign them really any way you want. And what we've done is, I mean, you've used the majority of one channel, a receive channel, for the receive data, for the two receive data channels that is multiplexed. And then I see we've used part of the second receive channel for some spy pins. Is that's all you're using it for, right? Just a couple.
Right, right. But they're 1.8 volt spy pins.
But because they have to be, because the interface is set to the same voltage level as the data is.
That's 1.8. That's right. So I left the second receive channel empty and didn't use the transmit channel at all.
Right. And the way it works is that whatever the IO channel voltage is, you get to pick one, 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3 per socket, and then all of the I/O pins are that level. Okay. So you can't have like a 3.3 volt receiver and a 1.8 volt transmitter on the same card unless you want to do the level translation yourself. The idea being that I really don't have that many banks in the FPGA to pick individual buses, voltages for individual buses. The problem I'm having is that I'm really out of I/O pins, and I know we're not going to use them for the first board. I want to reserve them in theory for all data engines, because there's going to be future data engines that are going to have enough I/O to hook up to all of these pins, plus all of the leaf board and plus all of the clock module and everything. So the idea would be that not just because it's assigned a particular function doesn't mean it necessarily hooks up and uses that function, but it's reserved for future use, shall we say. So I just wanted to run that by you. I know there's a lot of them that you don't use. So what I would do is I would maybe take the transmit bus and take part of the pins away, or likely I take the upper bits of the second receive bus, because it's likely you might have in the future a receiver and a transmitter on the same card, but it's less likely that we would need two receive buses and a transmit bus on the same card. So reserve that for a future higher performance data engine if we get to that point with this pin.
Are you going to need to change the pin assignments on the receiver module?
No, I do not want to change any pin assignments on the receiver module. I'm just running this by you as a general philosophical question.
Yeah.
I don't need that many pins, just a few, so I can steal the upper pins of the second receive channel. It's just that we won't be able to ever build a board for this data engine that needs two receive channels if we do that, two full receive channels. Unless, of course, we can repurpose some of the transmit channels. And like I say, they go to the FPGA. So, I mean, whether it's a receiver transmit channel, that the only thing that's restrictive is they have to be paired together, because that's physically done in the FPGA. But the pairs can move around anywhere in the FPGA, and they're programmed by us. So if we wanted a 32-channel input bus, we could make one out of the pins that are there and program it in the FPGA. So again, we could keep it to the pins that are assigned. So like, for instance, the power and ground pins, obviously you can't move those. So those would be fixed, but the other pins are programmable. So in the ICD for the data engine, well, it's going to be real fun defining that connector, because a lot of the pins will be more general purpose for the data engine. But when you plug in this particular RF module, they will be assigned a specific function for that module.
Okay. Well, so the module, I'm just going to leave the unassigned pins unassigned.
Yep.
And the data engine will have to know how to properly spread them between the two receive connectors.
Right. So the data engine, the person writing the FPGA code to talk to your module, will have to look at the ICD and figure out which pins on the data engine to program to talk to those pins that are defined in the ICD.
Right.
So I don't anticipate any change in the ICD. I just want to make sure that this is a reasonable compromise to make, because to the point now I have to compromise somewhere, or I'm not going to get everything. I can't get everything. So, and it really won't affect this board. It will affect future boards possibly, but I'm trying to pick the pins to remove on this data engine that will have the least possibility of affecting a future board. So we're guessing, right?
Okay. Yeah, the fact that we went to double data rate on the interface, you know, saved half the pins.
Yeah, so that really makes this possible. Okay. Sounds good.
I've got a couple of questions. First, what is the Raspberry Pi 4 kit that is being used?
Oh, it was just something I found on Amazon. It was I can go back and look up the exact details on it, but it, you know, it included the right power supply, a case, a fan, and a couple little bitty heat sinks that you stick on the chips before you, the chips that get hot before you put it in the case. And
okay. Yeah, I'm wondering, there's a Labist's one that has two fans, a big heat sink, and the power supply in case.
There's a million of them, but Canikit makes one that's pretty well liked.
You like that one?
I won't say I like it, but it's okay. You know, but you generally make a reputable. Good product.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I see. That's the other. That's another
one. We've used Cavikit Raspberry Pi Zero W kits. We like those pretty well.
Yeah, in the chat there was a mention of explainingcomputers.com, and he's gone through a whole ton of the various kits that are available in thermal performance. Yeah, and it's worth taking a quick look.
Good point. Second is actually more directly to the project. Is there a schematic for the clock board yet?
Not yet.
Okay, because I was just looking on the website to see where that status is. I know a lot of people are asking what kind of options they're going to be, and it'd be good to find out, be able to see.
Well, kind of see what I can pry out of John Ackerman, because he's going to be the one doing that. So.
Well, I know he is, and it's unfortunate, I think, that he doesn't come on here so we can ask him directly. But
yeah.
I do know that it's being designed to be flexible. So it can be anything from, you know, practically no.
Hold on a second. Let me, if you let me share here.
I know people are getting worried that you're going to need to buy a dual frequency GPS unit for it, and I know that that's not the case.
That'll be on the clock module, so you won't have to buy it. I mean, you'll have to buy it, but...
No, but I'm saying that the clock module does not have to have the dual frequency one unless you really want very accurate timing. Well, there are two reasons to do it. One is you have very accurate timing during geomagnetic storms, and the other is you can detect total electron content and get that data out to the web.
Right. So if you want to do TEC measurements, though, you're going to have the dual frequency model. So
that's what I'm saying. That's the reason to have the dual frequency module. But if you don't need absolutely the best timing, or you're not doing TEC measurements, you can use a much less expensive single frequency module.
Well, that's what we were saying too for the low cost personal space.
Right. And then also there will be various oscillator options, anything from a temperature compensated to, you know, as good and optimized oscillators you want to throw at it.
So I shared the screen. This is the block diagram that John used at his DCC talk.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this is basically where we're at right now for what the topology is going to look like.
Right.
So I think
what's the thing I'm trying to say is that it'd be good if John were to explain all the options that are available, because people are getting a little freaked out about how much this is going to cost. And it's not going to, if you just want the basic clock module, it's not going to be that expensive.
Well, I mean, if there's a substitute for the ZF9T, an inexpensive version.
Yes, there is. Yeah,
then we can, you know, we can build a clock module with that part of it and save most of the cost.
Right.
So
likewise, the VCO oscillator will have various options available to it.
Right, right. But I think what's going to happen is that the list of options is going to grow exponentially with each variant of clock and GPS and synthesizer chip. So what's going to happen is we're going to pick a couple stakes in the sand, so to speak, and we're going to build clock modules for those use cases.
Right.
And so the person who wants GPS time but doesn't really need dual frequency and super accuracy can buy maybe a $100 module instead of a $200 module. Or
something. Exactly. Like that. Yeah, and one thing I would say is that you it probably wants to be offered as a module that has everything but the receiver and the oscillator, and the user put the receiver and oscillator of their choice into it.
Probably not going to happen that way. It's going to be, the options will be up to us to do. And I don't, it's not going to be user assemblable. Okay. So the oscillator, the GPS is probably going to be a QFN type package, which is not going to be hand solderable.
Uh-huh.
I don't see how that's feasible.
That part's not that big a deal. Yeah. You can offer two different versions. There's the basic GPS and then the dual frequency.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not unamenable to multiple versions, but they got to have use cases that people want.
Right.
So we're not going to build a special one for three people, but even though the the three people will be very sure to tell us that we need to do that.
Yep.
And I mean, it depends on how hard it is to build, because if it has, you know, pads underneath the ICs that you can't really build without an oven, there's really not any point to releasing even a bare board, because it's anyway.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking in terms of, you know, they're leaving the GPS receiver and the VCO off, but we'll see. Well, I'm a time nut. I'd go for the high-end version, but I know that most people don't need that for this application.
Oh, well, perhaps we have a version that has no onboard GPS and it's an offboard GPS, and you plug that in too. Your GPS of choice.
Right. Yeah, that would you might have like a really good choice.
High performance one that I don't even know about that you want to use.
Mm-hmm. Well, the dual frequency one that John's looking at is a very good one.
But then, of course, you know what's going to happen is every year newer and better ones are going to come out. So
the other thing we have to do is we have to educate people why they need the better version.
That's correct.
You know, then everyone will become time nuts.
That's right.
So who's doing the marketing?
Explain to them why they need to be a time nut. That's the inherent.
Exactly.
We'll have John just go out, stand out, and he can hand out pamphlets and
proselytize.
Yeah.
So, Dan, I found my two boxes of Raspberry Pis. So, I'm set for testing of the magnetometers. And the question I had for you was: you sent me that file with the UDEV rules. For yes. Getting a Byte Blaster to work on Linux?
Right.
Well, I'm running Ubuntu 12.04. I believe it's 12.04 because 14.04 wasn't out when I built the machine. But I'm running 12.04 and I may have upgraded to 14.04, but not 14.04. I'm going to get this wrong. It's 18.04 I'm running. Okay, so one rev back of the LTS is what I'm running. And I had no problem just plugging the Byte Blaster in during installation and having the Altera software find it and install drivers. And I didn't have to do any funky stuff with UDEV file.
Well, that's interesting because I couldn't get it to work without putting the UDEV statement in.
Yeah, sometimes UDEV is needed if you have conflicting devices trying to use the same functionality, and you may need UDEV to tell it which device to use.
Okay. But Dan, you tried plugging the Byte Blaster in, it wouldn't recognize it, or what happened?
It would not recognize it.
Wow. Okay.
So I actually am using 2004 with QRTIS 20.1.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes a difference.
I'm going to find this out because I'm going to leave my Ubuntu at one rev back on LTS, but I'm going to upgrade the QRTIS to 20.1. because this is what the Intel guys are telling me I have to do.
So you know the LTS is good for 3 years from the date that it's put out.
Oh, three? Oh, I thought it was more than that. Okay.
No.
I thought LTS was 5.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, but.
Yeah, the LTSs are 5 years.
But you know, Dan, I'm not the king of upgrades, so let me step away. I always give Dan a hard time because his 30 seconds after the upgrade comes out, he's on there downloading and getting it, upgrading his system and breaking lots of things, which I hate. So he's got his phones on again. Now I can't diss him anymore. I was telling him about how you're the upgrade master, and 5 seconds after the upgrade comes out, you're on there downloading it, upgrading. And I hate that. So, I mean, I'll use, 5-year-old version with no updates. I don't care. If it works, you know, don't fix it. And I really don't have to deal with the internet or anything like that if it's a work PC. So security is not really as important as if I was like out surfing and email and, you know, all that. So.
Well, that's true. But the problem with Ubuntu is if you aren't with the latest and greatest, you're about 2 years behind on versions of software. So it's a little bit worse than most when it comes to keeping things updated. They don't do a very good job.
My experience with QRTIS is every time you upgrade QRTIS, you break lots of things. So if the Ubuntu and QRTIS together work and they don't break and everything works, I tend to just like not mess with it until I have to. Because It's usually very painful.
Yeah.
Scotty, which version is Intel recommending for Cordis?
20.1.
Okay, I'm sorry, which version of Linux?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Did you read any requirements, Dan, when you loaded 20.1?
I did not. I know that works. It seems to work pretty well on Ubuntu 20.04. So that's kind of where I'm at.
That's the latest one, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Good.
So,
David, I don't know if David's still there, but yep. I just wanted to say I think I fixed that bug with the software, at least an initial
thing. You mean we're not taking data?
When not logging data. Yeah.
I'll give it a try.
I think it's at least last I looked, it's been running for about 26 hours. And
okay. Well, it just has to run for 24 plus a second because it's on the
right. Yeah. Well, it seemed to do that.
Yeah. Good. Then, that's on the GitHub.
Yes. Okay. It's in the master.
So Dave, what did you mean by demonically possessed chip? Do you have some cool stories like things catching on fire or something?
I think I burnt my finger on one day, but I just can't solder them. I just can't solder those 0.5. You know, millimeters, and these little active terminators only have 6 pins. They're 0.6 or 0.065 or whatever it is, with lots of space between them, and they're a lot easier to solder. But you only have to have one in the whole thing anyway. It just goes on the end of the Christmas tree light string, I guess. I don't know. I haven't really exhaustively tried that. It's just that it's working for me now, and it's got me back to where I can at least work on software, which I've not been able to do for some time, and I'm very frustrated.
Yeah. My offer is still open if you want me to clean up some of the existing boards.
I really am going to try to take you up on that. I'll try to send them off later this week if I can get it done. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I maybe be bugging you, Dave, too, because I'm going to be inundated in boards here in about another week and a half, and may need some help trying to figure out how to talk to all of them and make sure they work before we send them out to everyone.
Well, you may need to know what options to use, but they should be some software that could talk to them one way or another. And
I'm hoping that your standard software will talk to it.
Yeah, it may need a little tweaking, but I'm probably going to be kind of offline most of at least the early part of next week. I may be listening, but I may not be worth listening to because the depending on what they give me to take.
Okay. Well, best of luck with that. Hope it all works out.
I agree. Good luck.
No, no. Yeah, I think it'd be fine.
So I can stop sharing this now here.
Yeah, I about know that by heart.
So the only other thing that I was doing this week was trying to figure out how we're going to clock the VLF board. And I think because it's very flexible and you can either run it in master mode or slave mode. And if you run it in slave mode, then you generate all the serial clocks for their, what is it, MSI port or whatever they call it. It's a four-channel serial, like it's a four-channel I2S port. But it turns out if you read all the fine print in the datasheet, they recommend for lowest noise that you actually run it in slave mode so that the drivers on the chip don't contribute to the noise of the analog to digital conversions that are going on at the same time, because when you run it at all four channels at 192K, it pretty much takes the entire conversion time to transmit the data. So there's no dead time where they can actually do the analog to digital conversions and then transmit the data separately like they can if you went at like 48 kilohertz. where you do the conversion and then you would transfer the data and do the conversion and then transfer the data. So they don't happen at the same time so that you don't get the noise of the transmission of the data, the digital transmission of the data back into your analog to digital conversion. So they recommend using it as a slave. So I guess the way we should do it then is that the data engine slash clock module, whichever, should supply the clock to the Cirrus chip and load the data off of it. And by us supplying the clock, we actually are controlling the conversion instant because the clock is going to come from us and the data coming out and the conversion that happens are locked together so that the rates are exactly the same. So does that make sense, Jonathan? If you're still here?
Yeah, yes, it did.
Okay, because it just seems like we want the lowest noise approach as possible. And so, I mean, if there's one's preferred over the other, it doesn't really matter to me. I mean, we could do it the other way too, but it just seems more simplistic to do it as a slave, and then the data engine supplies the clocks. And I haven't quite figured out if because there's an M clock and there's an S clock. The M clock controls the internals inside the part, and the S clock controls the data transmission across the communications bus. However, if you, for instance, if you were to put a crystal on the part and that drives M clock, now you must look at M clock and synchronize your S clock with M clock because it has to be 100% synchronized. Otherwise you're going to get out of sync with the A to D conversions. So in either case, we have to either look at the M clock coming back from the Cirrus chip and synchronize all of our comms to that, or we have to generate the M clock, in which case we synchronize our comms with that anyway because we're generating both M clock and S clock. Just seems much easier to me for us to generate M clock and S clock considering they are exactly 128x. The S clock's 128x, the M clock. So,
well, the S clock is generated on the Cirrus part. So the S clock.
Not if it's a slave.
Well, it's only, so in slave mode, the only reason for that, if you wanted to use multiple ICs, and in this case, we're only using one. So
that's true.
It'll only be
running in slave mode.
Well, that's if we wanted something like 8 channels or 16 channels and we wanted to add more.
Well, but you wanted 4 channels, right?
Right, yeah. So it'll be run in master mode. So we'll only have to supply it one clock, which would be the master clock, and it will generate the serial clock, and depending on the mode, it'll also generate the word clock or the LR clock too. So the serial clock and the LR clock, those are clock outputs, and those would be fed into the FPGA.
I suggest you go back and read the master section of the data sheet closely because S clock, LR clock, and data, data is always output, but both S clock and LR clock are generated during master mode only, and they're both inputs in slave mode. So if you go to slave mode, you have to provide the S clock. It won't provide it.
Right, yeah. Because in that mode, one of these ICs will act as a master, and it'll be outputting serial clock and word clock, and then that's fed into the other slaves if you have them. But we're only going to use one.
I understand that, but you do not, you're not required to use the master slave modes if you have only one. You can choose to use slave mode only if you have one part, and then the FPGA becomes the master and tells it what to do. And if you look in the fine print in there, it says that this actually creates a lower noise system.
Yes.
Because the output drivers, the S clock and the LR clock, are very high speed and they're very fast, and they will create noise inside the chip when you use them as outputs. But if you use them as inputs, then they don't create as much noise. So it seems like we might be better off using the part in slave mode, even though it's only one, we use it as in slave mode, and we'll have the FPGA generate the S clock and the LR clock.
Is there any disadvantage to running it in slave mode?
Not that I know of.
No.
So then why would you not do that?
Only reason you run it in slave mode is if you wanted to have, like Jonathan said, a board full of them. You'd have to run one in master mode, and then all the rest would be slave to that particular one.
Yeah, but what I think Scotty's saying is that we run them all slave mode.
We're only going to have one.
What? But if there's only one, either way, the thing is that you want to run it in slave mode because it's a lot easier to synchronize it to the data engine.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I don't see any reason why you would want to do it the other way.
Sky's right. You want
If you didn't have an FPGA, maybe if you didn't have a clock generator, because it.
No, I know, but in our particular case.
In our case,
and especially in our case, if you don't have.
We want everything as being master clock,
then you have to somehow synchronize the data engine to it.
Right, and we want everything that attaches. We want every single thing that attaches this data engine to synchronize the same clock.
Yeah. So no, you're absolutely right that you want to have the data engine and the clock board generate the clocks and the ADC slave to it.
Right. So then the S clock, M clock, and LR clock become outputs from the FPGA. And the data becomes an input, and the data is clocked based upon our S clock and LR clock. We'll accept the data based upon those two that we generate.
Now the M clock has to be clean, so you don't want it coming directly out of the FPGA.
So the another option for M clock is that, and this is a question I haven't got answered yet. So Jonathan, maybe you know the answer already, but like Dave says, the M clock has to be clean. So one of the ways you can do it is you could put a crystal oscillator on the board, and there's an oscillator there, so you put a crystal basically, and then the oscillator runs on the board. Then M clock becomes an output, and we could feed that over to the FPGA, which then we would have to use to synchronize the S clock and LR clock outputs back to the chip, because they have to be exactly divided by the right number of divisors, otherwise it doesn't work. Now
one thing that we could do that's actually simple and cheap is there are clock trying to think of the name, but they're PLLs chips that will clean up a clock for you. So
that's the question that I can't find an answer to. How clean does the M clock have to be coming into that part? There's no data in the data sheet at all.
I'll take a look at that. That's my job. I do that. I'll see what that does. But probably the thing to do is, if you're generating it through the FPGA, we put it through one of the it cleans up the jitter. We put that on the ADC card, and then we have a nice clean clock to feed to it.
Well, the other alternative is that we take the clock from the clock module and use that as the M clock input, and the M clock output comes to us from the Cirrus chip, and that we use that to synchronize everything.
Yeah, if you have a good programmable clock from the clock module, that's the way to do it.
I think that's the way Jonathan envisioned it anyway, isn't that?
Yeah.
Is that right?
But then that keeps everybody synchronized. You're not going to be slipping cycles, which is a real bear. And but yes, it's the M clock that has to be clean in these. The S clock and LR clock, you can have those jitter all over the place.
Yeah, because you're just digitally
getting the data correctly.
And I couldn't find anything in that data sheet. Now, Jonathan, have you looked at app notes or anything? I can't really determine the delay time between the actual A to D conversion and the S clock, the data coming out. They say that it's linked, so there is a fixed.
That actually, which chip is this again?
It's the CS5364.
Just a minute.
And I've been through the data sheet three times until my eyes glaze over, so
53.
Every time I go through, I find something new that I missed. So,
did you say 5364?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one of the problems, Scotty, is that that depends on the mode that you're running. You can put different, generally these chips will have different choices for FIR filters on the output. And that'll change the absolute sample point.
Oh, so what are we going to end up having? Are we going to have to build in the facility to measure the latency?
Or no. Do it? No. That's just a calibration step for the user.
So how are we going to get an accurate timestamp?
Well, you know what the system time is, and then you do know for whatever mode you set it to, you will know what the delay through the chip is.
Well, how
it is fixed, but
I know that it doesn't tell me.
We measure it. And actually, at VLF, if you're given the ambiguity, it probably doesn't matter as long as it's constant, which it is.
Well, what I'm thinking is, in terms of what goes on the board, I mean, I'd put a comparator on one of the inputs and then feed it to the FPGA as a sync input, and that way I can get pretty much an exact time of when the transition occurred, and then I can measure how long it takes for that transition to show up at my end. And then it's like self-calibrating. All I need is the reference point that where the input changes, and I can see where it changes in my.
Right.
Now, maybe that's simplistic, but I mean, I don't know any other way other than what we do is we put it on the lab bench, we measure it, and then this would become a concept that we would use from then on, because that will be the time delay that we measured.
Yeah. Let me look at this. The group delay should be determinant, and it may just be a matter of asking them. Most people aren't so worried about it, except when you're adding up delays in a professional audio system.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that they have a bunch of suggested front-end circuits to use, and right. Those look like they all have some delay in them also. So, I mean, where's your reference point? Is it at the ADC input? Is it at the antenna? Where is it that you need to?
It's at the ADC input.
It's at the ADC input? So that's where you want the timestamp reference to?
Yeah,
basically.
Okay. Yes. That makes it easier, I think.
Let's see. I wanted to mention that we're 20 minutes past for anybody that's time constrained.
You just have one more question. For Jonathan, I think so there's three different modes, communications modes, right?
Yeah.
Digital modes. So there's the left justifier, there's the I2C, and then there's the what do they call it?
The TDM mode, time division multiplexing.
TDM mode. Okay, so it looks to me like, and the problem is that the IO voltages can be 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3. However, you can't do TDM mode with 1.8 volt or 2.5 volt IO. It has to be 3.3. And I'm running notoriously short of 3.3 volt IOs. So it seems to me that you could, because the I2S mode, all they do is since I2S is two channel and TDM is four channel, all they do in I2S is they give you two data pins. So now you get four channels. Is that the way you saw it too?
So
you just clock two bits out at a time. So you clock two channels out at the same time.
Let me just check, double check this here.
Because if that's true, then you could actually run I2S mode rather, and still get all four channels. Now that wouldn't work for the six and eight channel ones, but that would work for the four channel one, I think.
Well, whether we use TDM or I2S is strictly a design. It's decision based on convenience. But the main thing is that we want to have all four channels available.
Right. That was my question. If we use I2S, it looks like I get four channels, but it's a little vague.
Well, right, that's the thing, because here I'm looking at the pinout here. So we have.
You see the data pins? There's two data pins on the four channel part, and there's four data pins on the eight channel part.
Let's see.
So implying that the clock would clock out actually two data channels simultaneously.
Yeah. Pin 30 and pin 27. So serial data out one and serial data out two, which is.
Yeah, so see one would be channels one and three, and the other would be channels two and four, if you look at the timing diagram, implying two at a time.
Yeah. So this was a decision based on convenience. So if you don't have a lot of 3.3 volt IO pins left, then this would work fine. Let's see here.
Okay, so, and you don't envision going to six or eight channels at all, right? Just sticking with four channels?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So I see here, initially when I first looked at this, I thought there was only one data out and not two. And that's why that I was so gung-ho about TDM mode, but I did look at this a little closer a while ago, and I saw these two data channels. So that will definitely work, and I figured that would be a decision that's up to you.
Okay, so if we can make either one work, then. I mean, I have no problem with TDM, except I need 3-volt IO for it.
Right, and if you're running low, then we could just stick with I2S, and
okay,
that's not going to be any issue at all.
It's easy enough to put a level translator in there too.
Yeah, this
to go to a lower voltage interface.
It's I guess there's no bidirectional pins here, so that's easy.
Yeah.
The only problem is I'm a little reluctant to put them in on the clock and the data because I don't want to mess with the skew between those two, especially at 50 megahertz. That's kind of slow, but kind of fast enough to be on the edge of worrisome.
Well, if they're all the same package, they should stay synchronized.
So Jonathan, if we do I2S, does that still mean we use that 49.1 megahertz clock, or do we get to slow it down? I don't remember. It's in that chart there in the data sheet.
Well, see, that completely depends on the sampling frequency that the user will choose.
Right, and I'm assuming maximum 192K, right? Because that's
no,
the worst case.
No, actually, the maximum is 216K.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're running at 192, right?
Would anybody really run a 216K instead of 192?
Well, 192 is kind of it's standard for audio, but there has been outside interest in ensuring that we can sample up to 100 kilohertz signals. And
so then you need to be at above 200.
Yeah. So that's why that the user would choose the clock rate where we would give them like a choice. So it would be, we would give them a choice of predetermined, clock rates, say, you know, 48, 96, 192, and 216, something like that. And from there, that would generate the appropriate clock signal.
By the way, go ahead.
And that appropriate clock signal would be coming from the GPSDO. And if you do want to run in master mode or in slave mode, then that clock will also go to the FPGA, and the FPGA would do the clock division, and that would drive the serial the data clocks.
Right. For the clock and LR clock, whatever they call it.
Yeah. So there,
Well, there's a lot of choice here, and I'm not really sure which mode would be optimum for this application. So that's why that I originally picked master mode, because I remember that you said that the ADD converters on the RF boards, they get their master clock from the GPSDO, and their data clocks are generated on the board, probably by the ADD converter.
No, the ADD converter doesn't generate them. They're always slave at those frequencies.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that if you have a clock module that doesn't have a synthesizer on it, you're not going to be able to specify any frequency that you want. So you're going to have to let the FPGA do the division, in which case it's going to be limited to certain frequencies, and you're going to get an FPGA quality clock from it, not an oscillator quality clock.
That's why we should probably put a jitter filter chip on the A2D card. I did find the group delay specification.
Okay.
It's on page 14 of the CS5364 data sheet, and it's rated in FS. You know,
okay. But that's the analog portion, right?
No, the analog port, this is the group delay of the digital filter, which is where the delay
actually. Oh, 12 over FS, okay.
So for the quad speed mode, which is the 192 kilohertz nominal mode, it's 5 over FS. So it's basically 5 samples delay.
Okay. But then that's in relation to what clock?
That basically is saying your sample point is 5 samples ahead of your output.
Right, right. But then there's also the transmission delay of transmitting the which, you know, it's actually it probably is only 1 FS to do that.
Right.
Because one sample period,
your output.
It takes 1 sample period to transfer all 4 channels of data.
Right.
Because the S clock is 256 times FS.
Right. You're doing time.
So I presume that it's probably going to be then 6 over FS because the data is going to be available at the time you start to transmit it, and it's going to stay stable during that entire clock. Yeah. So
I presume this is 5 samples ahead of when you're actually outputting the data.
Okay. So by the time I actually get the data, at that point, I could timestamp it with 6FS because it takes an FS to collect all the data.
Yeah. By the time you get it, it's 6FS.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. So now really the only issue is how are we going to generate that clock and how clean does it have to be, the M clock? You know, they suggest you just put a crystal on the chip and use that. Now, how clean is that? Well, I can synchronize. I'm going to have to synchronize it anyway if we use an external M clock. So I don't see if that's an issue. Then M clock becomes an output, and I just take that as an input, and I generate all my timing for the S clock off of that.
Yeah, but we're going to want this all synchronized to a GPSDO also. So I think it's a lot simpler to feed it the clock rather. We can certainly phase lock a crystal. That's one of the better ways of cleaning up the FPGA clock.
But if I interpolate the timestamp between GPSDO ticks, I don't think it's going to make any difference. You're just going to get an appropriate timestamp. And
the vision with this board is that it can only be used with the GPSDO that has programmable clock outputs only.
If that's the restriction you want to make.
Yeah.
That it has what outputs?
That this board is only to be used with the GPSDO that has programmable clock outputs. Only because we want to give the user the option for different sampling frequencies.
Okay, but Jonathan, suppose we said we didn't use it with a GPS DO that has programmable outputs, and we could limit the outputs, the rates to 192, 96, and 48K. And that's all you get if you don't use the programmable clock, because you won't be able to set it to 200 or 206 or 216 or anything like that. So you'll be stuck with these three rates. Or are you thinking that you just want to pick a single rate and have it always run at that speed?
Well, there might be situations where a user might not want to sample at a higher frequency.
Right, so you want to go to 48K then. So you want to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this though then. So really what I'm hearing is that the critical one is the high frequency. You want to be able to get above 100 kilohertz. So you want to have something above 200K as your highest sample rate. But when you go below 200K, it seems like just pick one of the three. So basically you got four sample rates. You need 48K, 96K, 192K, and then 216.
Yes.
And that's it. You don't ever need anything different than pick one of those four.
That probably would be sufficient.
Right. Yeah. Because if a user wants a lower sample rate, so their data files are smaller, or they don't really need a higher sample rate. So if you're going to work with a natural radio signals, you don't really need a very high sampling rate. If we're going to do the more serious stuff, then you do. So in situations where people might want to measure WWVB or any of the VLF transmitters that are in the middle of the band, that's why that I wanted to have 216 kHz available if they wanted it. This way, we could have the VLF module have its top limit of 100 kilohertz, and I know the RF module think the bottom limit is 100 kilohertz. So there was interest that there would be overlap, so we could capture something like, I don't know, say something like 5 hertz to 100 kilohertz. We would have that range for my VLF board, and anything higher, you would use the RF board.
Okay. I'm just doing a quick division here. So if we were to go to 216 kilohertz, we have to go to 55.296 megahertz clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so M clock would have to be fast. If we did that, we could go. Seems like we could. Okay, so there's dividers on the input side, and that frequency is assuming you use a divide by four on the M clock divider, but you don't have to use a divide by four. You can use something less than that.
Right.
So we might get away with, just a second here, I call it my calculator, 12.2888 times 64. That's not right. Anyway, what I'm thinking is that we could, if we picked a crystal.
What do you mean that's not right?
Maybe not worth it. If we picked a crystal that would run at 216 megahertz, we could make it an option on the board to disable the crystal and drive it with the FPGA at a lower rate, or with the clock oscillator at a lower rate. And because 192, 96, and 48K are all harmonically related, the powers of two, but 216 isn't. So you pick the weirdo frequency and you run that off the crystal, and then you pick the easily dividable by two generated frequencies and you run them off of the clock module or the FPGA. I want to be convinced that the FPGA will not be able to create a useful enough clock, a clean enough clock, because if you could just hook a 49 megahertz crystal up to the thing and put a couple bypass capacitors on it and call it good, that's not particularly super low phase noise or low jitter, is it?
It's lower than what you get out of the FPGA.
Well, yeah, it depends. I don't know what you're going to get out of the FPGA compared to that, because I don't know what the... I mean, there are receivers that use FPGA's crystal our clock outputs as their clock inputs. Now, everybody says don't do that, but nobody's actually been able to tell me how bad it is if I do that.
Yeah, well, I can quantify that, but...
That would really help.
The thing is that also something to be... Now, you're talking about for RF converters, correct?
For A to Ds?
Yeah.
Well, but that's what MClock's going to be, right? It's going to generate the gate.
No, but there's a difference between audio and RF.
Right. And I know nothing about that audio. I know that you right. don't do this for RF.
You're working with a 24-bit converter here, which is a lot different more than a 14-bit converter.
Okay. I'm so also dealing with a lot lower frequencies, too.
Right. But it actually is very sensitive to the jitter. It's like on the 10 picosecond level that you try to clean it up.
When you divide it down, don't you improve the jitter?
No.
Division? It seemed like you're averaging the jitter over many, many clock cycles if you're dividing by 256.
When you divide it, you still have the same edge.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, but it's a synchronous division.
Mm-hmm.
That last, but again, that last division gives you 10 picoseconds of jitter out of some huge long 5 microsecond clock here.
That's the specification. You have to have the clock good to that.
Yeah. Well, so the question is that crystal, the crystal, if they hang on there, is it going to, I mean, it's going to be a $1 crystal, right? How good is that going to be?
It's really more dependent on the layout than the crystal itself.
Okay, well, maybe the alternative is to put a DSPLL on the VLF board. And so you generate the cleanest signal you can on the VLF board, feed it into MClock, or feed it into the crystal input, I should say. Right. And then MClock comes out to us and tells us when the conversion happened. And then you don't have to near as the problem, because it's all it's doing is generating the digital clocks. It's not generating the analog clock.
I don't know. I'd be much more comfortable just having the main board generate the clock, clean it up on the VLF card, and keep everybody synchronous.
So then you're saying, well, everybody will be synchronous, because that M clock coming out is going to be what is going to synchronize things, except that you want...
Well, but if you're running RF at the same time, you're going to be on a different clock.
I guess if the receiver board wants 49.152 megahertz, it's beyond my comprehension how you're going to make that synchronous with the GPSDO. I mean, it's some weird old frequency that is not going to be in phase or in frequency lock with anything.
Yeah, we may need to think about this. There may need to be a synthesizer chip on to generate that clock.
I just think that even if you assume that the M clock is asynchronous and very clean, then the clock in is asynchronous and very clean, and the M clock coming out is a digital reconstruction of that clock, of the crystal oscillator coming in. So the crystal oscillator with an input and an output, if you drive it, you drive the input and ground the output. If you put a crystal across it, then you use both of them. And then the M clock is an output if you do that. Otherwise, you can throw the crystal away and you can drive M clock as an input and synchronize everything to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what you're thinking we should do, is use M clock as the input, because then everything else upstream from that is synchronized to it.
Right.
But I guess what I'm thinking is that if we use M clock as an asynchronous clock, as long as I interpolate between the 1 PPS ticks, then I'm going to have an accurate time of when this conversion actually occurred, no matter where it is.
But the problem is that you're going to drop or double samples if you're not entirely synchronous.
Well, I'm synchronous within 1 clock tick of what my clock speed is, which is going to be, because I have to double clock it to synchronize it, but that's the only uncertainty I get.
Mm-hmm.
So 8 nanoseconds, is that too much? 16 nanoseconds, 2 clocks?
Well, the problem is that, if your A to D is not synchronous with your system speed, it's going to be dropping samples or doubling samples, and you really don't want that.
Right, but so how are you going to make it synchronous with system speed? It doesn't really need to be because I'm going to be dumping it in. I'm going to be putting it into packets and sending it over Ethernet with timestamps.
We have to have a master clock coming from the clock board that then gets converted perhaps on the ELF card to the proper frequency, but you don't want them to be even a part per million apart because every now and then you're going to lose a sample.
I understand that, but I just don't understand how you're going to synchronize a 10 megahertz GPS signal with the 49.152 megahertz.
Oh, the synthesizer, clock. A frequency synthesizer.
You,
and we do it all the time.
But that's not an even division, so you're never going to get anything that's phase locked. It's going to always slide across.
No,
the 10 and the 49 is going to slide because they're different frequencies.
No, it's not. It's not. Not even.
Well, what I was under the impression that direct digital synthesis can produce the appropriate clock by calculating the offset from the primary clock.
Well, frankly, you don't want direct digital synthesis for this either, because that's actually a fairly dirty synthesis method.
Oh.
But there are a lot that basically this is a very common system clock problem that there are myriad chips out there available that will do this for us. And so, you know, for the 192 kilohertz sampling, we want a 49.152 clock.
Right.
And you can, you know, you feed 10 megahertz into one end of the synthesizer and it feeds that out the other end.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I understand you can do that, but you're going to use a fractional end synthesizer, right? Because this is not an integer divide from 10.
Oh, yes, it is. Oh, it is very much integer.
From 10 to 49.152?
Yeah. Well, it's a kilohertz. You know, you compare it at a kilohertz is the, you know, the rough idea. But in fact, there are a lot of factors in there that you can fudge one way or the other. I will admit that it's really too bad that the audio industry has picked these oddball frequencies. 44.1, let's not even go there. That's what Sony picked. It's 2 squared, 3 squared, 5 squared, 7 squared. Ask them.
All I know is that we did HPSDR. They tried to use 125 kilohertz because that was a nice, easy clock crystal
right.
You could buy. And havoc ensued. So we want to avoid this problem.
Right. Yeah. But the 48 kilohertz is a lot closer to, you know, an even thing. I wish they had just done 25 kilohertz, 50 kilohertz, things like that, but they didn't.
They didn't. So we're stuck with these weird frequencies. And yeah.
Talking to an old synthesizer and professional audio designer, this is my job.
But the fact is, how are we going to synchronize everything from the single board computer all the way back down, because two clocks at the same frequency aren't, unless they're derived from each other. So you're always going to get an overrun or underrun eventually. So well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the 12288 kilohertz samples and I'm going to package them into Ethernet frames and I'm going to put a timestamp on the beginning. And I'm going to throw them into a FIFO.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go. Ethernet's essentially zero latency because it's way faster than we are than our data rate.
Right.
So they're just going to go in the FIFO and disappear.
Right.
To somebody else who is going to deal with them. And mm-hmm. they're going to have timestamps on them that will be 122.88 kilohertz apart. Or sorry, 192 kilohertz apart. But they're going to be determined by my 192 kilohertz clock.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So the guy who's consuming those packets on the other end is not running at exactly the same speed.
That's right. Well, this is the classic problem of getting audio or video or anything from one point to another. But our job is to package it up in coherent packets and then send it off. And we have to send it a little bit faster than it needs to be so that at the other end, it can be unpacked and then concatenated properly.
But how does it get decoded at exactly the right frequency? Because you don't have that information.
Well, that's Yeah, there's a bit to that, and that's an art.
So then, is the way we're doing it, just dumping it over Ethernet, is that acceptable? Because realistically, I mean, what are you going to do with the data, right? I mean, that's the question. Yeah. Right?
For scientific purposes, this is probably fine. But you want to do your best not to put glitches into the data. But, you know, within a certain amount of a certain period, you know, if you take 2 seconds of data and analyze it, and then you go to the next 2 seconds, that's acceptable. But
okay. It occurred to me, too, that if our timestamp is accurate enough, you could adjust your sample clock on the other end to match up to the sample times of each.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do that. We actually do that with, for instance, rocket data that comes down, and it's not synchronous with what we've got down on the ground. And then we actually have to run an adjustable clock in the software, in the analysis software, to get it to line up properly.
So I guess then I agree with you that we need to make the frequency as accurate as we can, but mm-hmm. I don't agree that the phase coherency makes anything. It's not going to be phase coherent anyway. So it's, and it will be off in frequency too, not by a little amount, but it'll be off.
The thing is that, especially if we're running different receivers in different locations, synchronizing them to GPS, each of those receivers will be starting a sample period at the same time within our specifications, 50 nanoseconds.
Yep.
But they will all be doing it in the same way. So then when you get all the data down and work and analyze it, you will know that the beginning of each of those sample periods is aligned. But you don't want it dropping samples or doubling in the middle.
One of the interesting things it says in the data sheet is if you want to synchronize, like what Jonathan was saying, with you have a master and multiple mm-hmm. slaves, what you want to do is you want to release the reset synchronous with the clock.
Correct.
So they all come out of reset at the same time and they're all synchronized together.
Yeah, we do need to do that, even if we're doing all slaves. If we only have
one, but we still have a reset to it. So, I mean, we can control when it.
Yeah.
But so I guess the question then is, if we're feeding it this 59 megahertz clock, which is, I think, about roughly 20 nanoseconds,
mm-hmm.
and we release the reset synchronous with the GPS, PPS, then don't we have our conversion synchronized within 20 nanoseconds of the PPS?
Basically.
So maybe the clock doesn't have to be synchronous as long as the reset is synchronous with our GPS.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, but you're not going to get it more accurate than 20 nanoseconds anyway.
No, it's not a matter of the accuracy in that case. It's a matter that your clock is going to be slipping and you're going to your samples are not going to be synchronous.
Well, okay, so the purpose of the phase locking to the GPS is to get the frequency dead on.
Correct.
Yep.
So then we're going to make the requirement that you have to have a GPS DO to run this.
Yes.
And how much of a GPS DO to run it? Do you need a dual channel fancy one with a synthesizer on?
Not for this application.
I guess then what I'd rather do is I'd rather feed 10 megahertz reference to the VLF receiver and have you phase lock to that. Let you do it. Because then you can make it as good or as bad as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then that means that I could take a relatively inexpensive GPS that's not a dual channel, say, but that generates a good stable 10 megahertz.
Right.
Phase lock to that, then we're all done, right?
Correct.
Well, I'm not really familiar with doing it. I would have to learn how to do it, do that. Well,
David's here to help us.
That's right.
Well, that's why that I figured that the GPS DO can take care of it, because I was thinking that there may be situations where maybe other boards that there might be a need for a specific clock coming from the GPS DO.
Well, I'm just trying to avoid putting a requirement on your receiver that you have to buy a $300 GPSDO to go with it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to put the requirement that it might be only a $50 one or a $100 one.
Is there a version of the clock board that does have a Silicon Labs or equivalent frequency synthesizer?
That was the theory, but there's basically three versions. There's the dummy version, which has nothing on it.
Right.
That's the baseboard generator. Then there's the one with the dual frequency GPSDO on it that has just buffers. And then there's one that has a synthesizer chip also. And that's the one that's going to be required for this if you need a specific programmed output.
No, we don't want the middle grade to be dual. Well, that's why I brought up the question earlier. I think we need more versions than you're laying out. We need to talk to John.
Yeah.
Well, see,
because what we need here is a garden variety GPS with a disciplined oscillator and a Silicon Labs synthesizer.
Like a 10 megahertz, a $10 Chinese GPS?
Practically, yeah. As long as you can discipline the oscillator with it.
Yeah. And then the synthesizer chip so that we can get...
Right.
Because the idea is we have four outputs. We have one to each RF board. We have one to the clock module. We have one to the leaf board, which will be to the radio, the VLF radio. Excuse me. And then one fed back to the FPGA. So that's the four outputs.
So the Silicon Labs synthesizer should be adequate for this application because it's intended to be used for receivers and such.
So Jonathan, would that fulfill your requirements? If we didn't have a dual charger? I'll have
to check it, but I'm pretty sure that it'll be clean enough for this because it is intended to be used as a local oscillator. As a master clock for...
I'm sure that it would work fine. Although, if I was going to pick a GPS, I would definitely pick a GPS timing receiver.
Right, but But for your application, you don't need the dual frequency version.
Why? But I mean, if our clock module that John's designing is going to have a dual frequency, why wouldn't we be...
Is very expensive.
But Jonathan's board's going to just ride, is going to be an add-on to what we're already doing, right?
If you put the requirement that you have the GPSDO on the data engine, you just added $300 to the cost of the VLF receiver.
What you're saying is that
we're every one of these is going to have the dual frequency GPS on it.
Well, it will if that's the only GPSDO we make, but that we don't want to do that.
I don't think you want to do that, and I don't think you need to do that.
Yeah. So
I'd love to have a TEC coming out of all of these guys, but
that was the whole point of modularity is that you pick the one that is sufficient for your needs and not excess. Right.
But I think you're going to want a version of this that has the single frequency timing receiver, the disciplined oscillator, and a synthesizer.
So here's the way I'm envisioning the clock setup then is that if we do what you said, David, and we put what Jonathan wants is a separate output off of the clock module, mm-hmm. that's a separate synthesizer channel that you can program to whatever frequency you want, but it will be locked to a GPS.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I can also do is, and this is fits right in line with the dummy module, is that in the case that you don't want a GPS at all, you put the dummy module in which case then the clock is generated by the FPGA,
mm-hmm.
and then you get much lower performance,
right.
And you maybe have to plug in a GPS and figure out a way to synchronize it with that, but mm-hmm. then you don't need any GPS on the clock module itself. You need a dummy clock. But that's the low-cost version.
Right.
So.
Most people use sound cards with this software.
Okay.
And my vision for this board is a high-performance board that would perform better than most sound cards.
So don't worry about the low performance one then. In other words, they'll use a sound card if they want a low performance one.
Right. Yeah. So the only reason why that I chose this IC is because of the performance, and what I'm shooting for is science grade VLF data that can be synchronized with receivers in multiple locations around the world through GPS.
Which means you're going to need a high performance timing GPS anyway, not necessarily dual channel, but
correct.
Well, what would be
a question? Is there a way to design it so that if you have a Tangerine with the high performance GPS, the VLF will be able to make use of that? Where at the same time, if you just plugged in the low performance oscillator module, your performance will just degrade, but you will get that high performance you want so long as you just plug in the correct module.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that the oscillator this makes that one not useful for anything, but the four outputs are just a clock distribution amp. So in other words, the oscillator on the board is the oscillator that both RF modules get and the leaf module gets and the FPGA gets. Mm-hmm. So you can't program them individually. So you can't get your 49.152 megahertz on this plus 122.88 for the RF modules. So generally what will happen is that these are going to be set to 122.88 megahertz, which means it will not be useful. The clock output will not be useful for this particular board.
For the VLF. So the problem with the VLF board is it has these oddball sampling rates.
Right. So you have to have a separately programmable output to generate the proper clock.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that we could generate them on the FPGA with dividers if they are... We could generate maybe 12.288, but then the quality goes down. So
but then as soon as you put in a high quality, the high performance GPS module, then it reverts back to the high performance case.
That you've missed here.
Okay.
The 122.88. Guess where that frequency comes from?
Well, it comes from the VCXO.
No, why is that picked?
Well, because that's what I'm saying. It's a divider down to 96, 192, and all those, but it's not a divider down to 216. So,
but that's different. But we're not talking, the point that I'm trying to make is it actually is an audio frequency times 100.
Yeah.
It's times 10.
Times 240.
2.288 is our fundamental... 40 millihertz crystal frequency.
And from what I can see, you could program this part to use 12.288 as the master clock input if you change the divider. 40
kilohertz, yeah.
So even at 192 kilohertz.
Well, the 122.88 is very close to a clock that we want to use.
Right, but
division.
Okay, but... It's not the clock that we can use because this part won't take that frequency as an input. However, I will have that frequency in the FPGA and I can digitally divide it down by an integer and provide you with a clock out. Now, is that going to degrade the performance of the clock enough to make it not useful as a source? Because the 122.88 will be synchronous it'll be locked to the GPS, right?
What I'm thinking is maybe we feed the VLF card the 122.88,
and we let Jonathan divide it down.
Synthesis on which is very simple at this point to create a clean clock for the ADC on the VLF card.
122.88. I think it's a divide by 2.5 to get to 49, or divide by 10 to get to 122 or 12.288.
Yeah. So what you do basically is you multiply by 2 and then divide by 5.
Right.
And there are chips that do that very easily and clean enough.
But it looks to me like if we use I2S mass or slave, we can set the clock divider such that we can feed in an M clock of 12.288 megahertz, which is just a divide by 10 off the 122.88.
Right.
Well, so how would he do that on his board compared to how I would do it in the FPGA?
Well, first, you don't want to divide it in the FPGA. You want to have an outboard divider, but that's easy enough to
put. Why is that important?
Because it's a lot cleaner.
Well,
you don't want to have it.
Everybody tells me it's a lot cleaner, but nobody can tell me exactly why that is. So send it over at 12.288 and then clean it up over there. Is that a possibility?
We could do that, yes.
But probably dividing it down is easier to clean it than that gives you some options for cleaning
it. But it's also easy to divide it cleanly externally.
Yeah.
Because you don't have all the other logic going on at the same time.
Yeah. Well, let me talk. Well,
let's think about this, but I just realized, wait a minute, 122.88, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So let me talk to John and see what, because
it doesn't
the barrier get is, out of the, is having the synthesizer output on yeah, the clock module.
That doesn't get us out of the problem of creating a clean clock for the 216 hertz, but it does work for all the others.
Yeah. And see, here's another alternative, too, is that we could, if we wanted just one particular frequency out of the clock module, we could put the synthesizer over there. It is a dedicated output to the RF board, or to the leaf module.
Right.
So, although feeding 122.88 would make everything work and letting you divide it down on the leaf board, on the RF board, the VLF board.
VLF board, right. Put the division there.
With 4896 and 192, if you use 12.288 megahertz, you only have to set the master clock divider, set it to divide by one.
Right.
Right. That's for 192 kilohertz, and that's for all of them, right. And then you vary the S clock frequency.
Right.
Well, it's generated, if you use slave mode, it's not. But S clock doesn't matter because I'm just going to divide that down. And that doesn't have to be clean. It's the M clock that's important.
Well,
right, yeah.
Well, it's after
so there's a couple options. We could just create the 12.288 megahertz output, or we could create a 122.88 megahertz output and let the leaf module figure it out. Don't forget, this is a leaf module. This isn't a VLF module connector. Mm-hmm. So this board is usable for other things also. So keep in mind, ideally it has a synthesizer on it. And you can program whatever frequency you want. But right, there's going to be a version of a clock module that doesn't do that. So then we have to pick a standard frequency.
Okay, well then, how about, say, for a high performance, for the high performance 216 kilohertz sampling rate, we require the GPSDO, and for 12.288 megahertz, which we can use for 192, 96, and 48, that can be the lesser performance clock module. We could do that.
Okay.
But
I think that works.
I never really envisioned lower performance on this.
Okay.
That's all.
That might be a reasonable way to think about it right now. And I've got to jump off here. It's after 11 o'clock. But you can easily get the 48, 96, and 192 off of any clock system. And
well,
then
you can do it by changing the registers inside this part with one clock frequency.
Right, exactly. And then if you want to get the high performance 216 kilohertz or something in that range, then you have to have the full-blown clock board.
Well, let me talk to John. I'll talk to John tomorrow and bounce this off of him and see what he can come up with.
Yeah, great.
So meanwhile, I think that the architecture is going to end up being that D clock is going to be an input to the RF module, to the VLF module, and the output will be M clock, S clock, and LR clock, frame sync. And that way we'll operate it in slave mode, but the clock will come from us.
Right.
and that somewhere, either the clock module or the FPG or the data engine someplace off board. And then we'll try to figure out what frequency that needs to be and what, whether it needs to be divided down by Jonathan or whether we give it to him the way he wants it and he just cleans it up or how that works.
Right.
But it will be, the clock will be an input to the RF board and the other three clocks will be outputs and they'll right. be digital clocks. So they won't matter. And they'll be all synced to M clock and then we can synchronize M clock and we're done. Right. If we could figure out how to do that.
Now the thing is, I would suggest that you do the S clock, LR clock generation in the FPGA.
Yeah, I will.
Right. Okay.
And I'll base it on the M clock coming out.
Right. So the A to D in the VLF is running in slave mode, but it's getting
right.
a master clock also from.
Because I'm presuming that the actual A to D conversion takes place based on M clock. And the digital shifting out of the data is controlled by S clock and LR clock.
Right.
Because they make it very clear that
you synchronization, but then it gets set.
Right. So actually they make it so you can break it if you don't synchronize those two.
Right.
So, and I love it. It says, well, you know, you can pick the frequency that you want. It says S clock and LR clock ratio can be set according to design preference. However, device performance is guaranteed only when using the late ratio shown below.
Right.
So, which of course we will do. So.
Yeah. I noticed they actually are talking a lot about synchronization internally and all that and keeping the noise. You know, there's a sample internal sample point that you're trying to keep away from the data output because yeah. it actually generates noise on the chip.
Yeah, yeah. And you can be more or less successful depending on the rate yeah. you're running
at. And at the 24-bit level, it makes a difference. You can see it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, thanks. I don't want to take this till 3 in the morning. See, this is my advantage, you see. When you guys start at 8 o'clock in the morning, that's like 5 a.m. here.
Right.
But now it's only 8 o'clock, so it's like no problem for me.
Yeah, no trouble at all for you.
Right.
All right.
No, but I appreciate it. I think this is going very well. I think these discussions
are well, it's useful and we have to figure this out. So
yeah.
Yep.
I know I look like I'm falling asleep here, but I
oh, that's okay. So did you ever get a time for a conference call between Jonathan and the other
Casey? Folks?
Yeah.
I don't think I heard back from Casey yet because Jonathan just sent out the new doodle today, and I just forwarded it off to Casey, so we'll find out later.
Okay.
So if it doesn't work this week, it'll be next week.
See if I can get with John tomorrow, and then whenever that conference call is, I should have more information on what he thinks we should do.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is we seem to be doing a good job of, you know, collaborating with a lot of people all over the place, and I think that's good.
Well, you know, like with David, I'll argue, but I'll be convinced too. So, you know,
you'll be convinced.
I bow to other people's more experience, so yeah. I just want to be right.
Yes, I agree. I think if we can just make it right and make it useful, I think.
Although
I'd
rather not make it synchronous, if there's a reason, then I think that it needs to be. So then we do it.
Yeah. No, I think there's probably a good reason for it.
It's just that I'm so burnt out trying to figure out how to get all these clocks connected. I just, whoever thought that 500 IOs would not be enough? when I first got that, I thought, cool, I got enough IOs to burn, and now I'm so it's like.
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And you know, it occurs to me too that two data lines of I2S. Running at say 1.8 volts, that's going to be quieter than the TDM running at 3.3, even if it's at the same frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I think. So maybe we're better off running the I2S instead of the TDM.
Good work.
So, all right.
All right.
You have to resort to
burning everyone's ears out.
Yep. You may have to resort to time division Morse code.
Okay, I'm ready. Can we copy that by ear?
Yeah. On that note, I'm going QRT.
Okay.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night.
Thanks, hey, guys.
Dan, you got a minute? Can you hang around? Oh, Dan's gone.
No. Dan? Yeah, I've got a minute.
Can you lead us up, Nathaniel?
Yes, I will leave that. I'm stopping the recording. I'll leave it.